Yeah, remote attacker mic can't get to it under my keyboard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could always just...
Fingers aren't that long. Hey, Chase. We're here again.
Yep, just another day.
So we spent a lot of time last week pointing out some issues when it comes to web design and some of the vulnerabilities that come with that.
Yeah, and we only received a small amount of hate mail. I was really expecting a lot more. Well, expecting and hoping for a lot more.
I did get some good feedback from a listener that we need to be careful about using shorthand or acronyms without explaining what they are. We live in the three-letter acronym world, so it's easy for us to fall into that without thinking about it. Mm-hmm. But we started to touch on something at the end of last episode that I wanted to carry on into this episode. And that is the hacker methodology or hacker mindset. There's a lot that goes into it. And one of the things that is hardest to train yourself on is how to think like a hacker, how to look at something from the perspective of someone who tears something down just to build it up better.
Yep. I'd say that thinking like a hacker would benefit both the red team and the blue team guys. Red team for obvious reasons, but the blue team guys can use that mentality to stand back, take a look, and view their network through the lens that an attacker would, which would help them allocate resources and devote their time in the appropriate manner.
Right. And even developers or infrastructure architects, any of those other technical groups can benefit from that perspective and that mentality as well, because it gives you a sort of perspective on secure design and how someone with that mindset already might look at that these subjects that you're designing or applications that you're building.
Yes, I'd say from the red team perspective, it's arguably one of the most important things that a red teamer can do is get in that mindset, because the technology will always be changing. It'll be constantly evolving. And one of the ways to keep up without knowing a ton about every single piece of technology is just being able to understand how things work and how to break things.
Absolutely. Now, we wanted to bring in an expert on breaking things, and that couldn't be anyone better than actually our boss and one of the founders of Black Lantern Security, Michael Reske. Mike, can you say hi?
Hello.
So, Mike, if we could have give you a different title in the company, probably Chief Breaker or a champion of privilege escalation would be either of your titles.
Maybe Techno King. Black Lantern Security.
Yeah, I could see that fitting in there.
So, Mike, can you give us a little bit of your background? When did you get started into security, especially when you're looking down the red team route?
So my journey into the industry started probably around the early 2010, I want to say, is really when I started getting into this field. I started working for the DoD there for a little bit, doing, you know, general IT, doing, you know, compliance and things like that, verification, validation, those types of testings and activities. And then I had the opportunity as a part of a seminar that the Marine Corps put on where I got to participate in a CTF. And I told one of my colleagues that is like, you know, he was like, you got to do this. You got to, it's a hacking CTF. You got to try it. You know, you're really into this stuff. And I was like, well, you know, I probably shouldn't, because, you know, I'm it's going to suck up all my time. I'm going to get devoted to it. I kind of have this, you know, addictive personality when it comes to these types of things. And so I ended up taking the class, taking the course that they offered at the seminar. And I ended up winning second place. And I actually got to talk to the guy who put it on. I got to talk to some of his other contacts. And I actually got to meet one of the lead guys at the Marine Corps Red Team. And that turned in kind of an internship, kind of a leave of absence, if you will, to go tour with them for a little bit. I got to do some really fun stuff with those guys, really got to cut my teeth. And when I got back to my regular DoD job, I got introduced and got introduced to their network SOC, Security Operations Center, and got onto their red team. I started out kind of as a junior operator, worked on that for a little bit, worked my way up with some of the other colleagues that we now work with at BLS. And I became the deputy director there for a little bit. And that's kind of like my entry point to do that. I got to work some really interesting folks I'm still friends with today, and I actually do work with those guys today. And that I kind of just fell into it. I didn't really set as an outset. You know, my college and career background was in IT, was in IT security. I always wanted to do these types of things, but didn't really find it whenever I first worked in the DoD. But then, like I said, happened chance, I just kind of fell into it and just started excelling at it and started working my way up.
Now, you mentioned that your background is in information security. What do you have degrees? Just bachelor's, master's?
So I got my undergrad at the University of Texas in San Antonio. They had a degree program down there that was part of the DoD. They basically were an accredited university, and so the education piece, the program was very centric to IT security and network security. So I was fortunate enough to get a scholarship program where I got brought on. They basically paid for my college education. They also gave me opportunities to do internships with DoD agencies. And then I applied again to continue to do my master's with them. And basically, I kept that going until they said, you know, we're not going to pay for any more of your education. And so that's kind of where it grounded in. I had some really great professors. A lot of them were former DoD or current DoD employees. I had some really great professors that came out of the Air Force. And from there, you know, just kind of grew, kind of took an interest and just kept on going. And it just kept on working. So
it just kept hacking and it kept working.
It just kept working.
People kept paying me money. I just couldn't stop.
Yeah.
That is awesome, though. So it's always interesting when I hear a lot of these, a lot of origin stories, even for people who don't come from the military, there's oftentimes some kind of tie to the military, tie to the government in a lot of the stories that come from people that are, you know, been in the industry longer than, you know, not to out you, Chase, but using you as an example, you actually have a degree in cybersecurity.
Yes.
So, you know, not to out you, but you're younger and you just, I guess, within the last 3 years. Is that right? Remembering 3 years you graduated ago?
I graduated in the spring of 2019. I was the first class that went fully through my school cybersecurity program. Pretty much anyone else who graduated before me, they transferred in from one of the other disciplines because it was under the School of IT. I got to say that cybersecurity programs, at least from my experience with the one I went to, it could use some work. It does a good job of teaching a lot of things, but it needs to specialize a bit more, offer a bit more specialized paths. But the most value that I got out of it was my school required 5 semesters of internships. They were all paid, and my first one was doing data analytics, project management, and then that's actually how I came to meet Sam on my second company.
Yeah, and I put you to work in a SOC, taught you how to actually do security.
Yeah.
So I guess with that in mind, that's always an interesting sort of dichotomy that still exists within the industry as it is today. And I think that comes from the result of a cybersecurity as an industry. Well, I guess that's a weird statement in and of itself, is cybersecurity as an industry is still fresh in many perspectives. Security isn't fresh, but it used to be split up amongst the technologies. Because my degree is in networking, so I had some networking security classes, but we didn't have a security degree, right? So I guess, Mike, in your time, how have you seen those changes in the industry affect what you get to do, either through the DoD or when you work for private groups or contracting groups, or even when you've started your own company?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because when I got into security, when I started actually getting into my career course, that was, you know, circa 2006 is when I got down to San Antonio and started taking courses down there. And, you know, that was still, you know, it's still developing. It was still maturing, if you will. Cybersecurity really wasn't even a term back then. As I you know, age myself there a little bit. And, you know, now, you know, I've talked to my professors back at UTSA, and I communication with them. And actually, it's funny. I just was talking to one of my forensics professors who is the dean of the cybersecurity program down at UTSA. And, you know, she's trying to formulate a new program altogether. And so she asked me for input to kind of say, you know, what do you think about these classes? What do you think, you know, we should add, remove? And, you know, they're focusing so much more on straight cybersecurity topics and areas of speciality. You know, she has courses in there that are focusing primarily basically just on, hey, how do you do incident management, you know, science? How do you do threat hunting investigation, investigation theory, detection engineering? All these terms, all these specializations that have come out in the past 10 years, I would say. And, you know, it that just wasn't a thing. You know, IT security was by nature IT. Now you have large debates and large conversations around, well, security should be separate and alone from the ID department and organizations and things like that. And so, you know, and the evolution that I've been in, and I was a newcomer when I came into this industry, when I came into this field. There are a lot of people that I got to know and I got to work with when I worked in the DoD that had been in this game a lot longer than I have. And it's always interesting to hear and to understand where people come from. Like, for example, Chase in the past 3 years, I mean, he went through a cybersecurity program. That just didn't exist. And so you are starting to see a lot more focus, a lot more specialization. And even within the security field, you're starting to see these specialty programs and where I'm just the guy who does Splunk. I'm just the guy who does firewall rules. I'm just the guy that does X or Y. Where it used to be, I just do security. I do everything. And there seems to be less of a jack of all trades and more of the mindset of I'm a particular, you know, individual with a skill set. So it's just it's constantly changed, I think, in the recent years to have this manifestation and these evolution of these teams where the breadth is just so wide with the capability and the talent of these teams, not let alone within the college and let alone within the universities. But as well as working with customers and working within the DoD, I've seen these people to start to really get into these niche roles that bring an entire amount of wealth and intelligence and capability that wasn't there 20 or so years ago.
And one of the things I'm liking about the evolution of a lot of these cybersecurity programs is that it is bringing us a departure from the traditional cybersecurity person, which usually has, like Mike and myself, ties to the military, because the military does a good job of teaching these things, but it also does a good job of encouraging people to have a similar mindset about it. And so these cybersecurity programs that are coming in, bringing civilians, fresh people, they have a different way of approaching situations, a different way of thinking. It's this diversity that is just improving the industry as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because of the fact that, you know, the internet started as a DoD program, right? As a DARPA research project. You know, it used to be a very closely held secret or closely held cookie jar, if you will, when it comes to hacking, when it comes to technology and things like that. To Chase's point, over the past, you know, years, you've really starting to get an inclusion of other people outside of direct military personnel. A lot of the big firms, you know, like Mandiant and FireEye and Splunk and a lot of these, you know, Endgame and all that type of stuff, these are people that operated and were in those DoD military spaces that took that expertise, that took that intelligence, and then went and started these private sector companies. You know, I mean, I'm a direct evolution of that, if you will. I was not a DoD, you know, military enlisted or an officer, but, you know, I was a civilian that took what I learned to bring it out to hopefully benefit to the rest of the public and the rest of the you know, private industry that's out here. And the other thing to Chase's point is it's really interesting to see and working with some of these people that I've come in and worked with on a daily basis that don't have traditional education or don't have traditional, you know, IT background. One of our other partners and owners in BLS, Dr. Phil Hartlib, you know, he has his degree in material science. Yet he is probably one of the most intelligent and most thoughtful person when it comes to approaching a problem or approaching how to tackle something from not only from an IT security perspective, just in general, you know, problem solving, critical thinking. And so you've got these characters across the field now that really can take a different approach to breaking something when it comes to the traditional hacking or fuzzing or reverse engineering type of stuff, to even people in the finance and the different fields of taking the eye of security when it comes to these different lenses of companies. When you go up and assess them and you're trying to equate or to quantify risk in certain aspects, it's really interesting to see non-IT people approach these problems and then try to apply, you know, either remediation or a solution to a problem that the industry or that the specific company or customer may be experiencing.
I think that's the second time a guest has mentioned Phil, so I think our next episode has to have him on it.
Yeah, this one mentioned his full title. The last one just mentioned him yelling at somebody who called the cops on Paul.
That's true. Yeah. I really like the concept of the perspective of the diversification that we're seeing within the industry, because it's, you know, full due respect to the graybeards out there, but you know, they've been in the trenches for decades at this point. And now we're seeing a lot of new fresh blood, a lot more people being able to become available and willing to do this work beside them. I still think personally that security is hard from the sense of it's time consuming, it's ever changing, and you face unique problems that you are not going to face in most IT related situations. But security has this ingrained hill of burnout that I don't think you see in all technical fields, but I think that can be combated with passion. We see it with all of the guys we work it with day in, day out. We were up in the wee hours of the morning because we can't stop thinking about a problem that we've been working on overnight or all throughout the day. So, you know, bring in the diversity, bring in the people, but I also think we need more people with more passion is kind of where I'm going with that. And, you know, we see that with our team, we see that with a lot of the other security firms and the vendors out there. You talk to some of their engineers and they're programming 16 hours a day just to go crash and then get up and do the exact same thing the next morning.
I would rather work with someone who has the passion and the willingness to learn than someone who has all the knowledge already, because it's a constantly evolving and changing field, and you're going to need that willingness to learn and that passion in order to stay relevant.
We've seen most recently, as cybersecurity has gained in popularity, it's become one of the biggest booming industries, I would say, in the past 5 to 10 years. And, you know, burnout is a real thing. You know, there's only so much a human being can commit themselves to in any given day, with any given month. And COVID surely hasn't helped that, with, you know, you wake up, you roll out, and you walk downstairs and you're in front of your computer and you sit there for maybe 12, 14 hours a day because you can't go anywhere else. And there needs to be, I think, more focus in our industry about work-life balances. The problem with this and trying to balance it is that things move so quickly in our industry. Things that were relevant 3, 6 months ago is ancient. In some aspects, the same technique that you may use for phishing one day, or that you use for a privilege escalation or a bypass, doesn't exist the next day. Windows and Microsoft specifically has done such a great job, I think, in the past 5 or so years with their platform and how they've pivoted that company as of recently with, you know, Windows 10, with Windows Defender and things like that. There's a constant, you know, we always talk about this cat and mouse game, and I think it has gone into turbo mode, and you either have the latest and greatest, or, you know, your fish isn't going to land, or your local privilege escalation LPE isn't going to work. People are getting better about patching on time. Now, generally they are. That doesn't mean that every organization or every industry is good at that, but it's become a little bit harder, I would say, from an attacker's mindset, from a red team or from a penetration tester, to keep up with that. So that affects that burnout, if you will, because you always feel like you have to push that limit and push that envelope, because if you don't, you're going to fall behind. The second point is the fact that when I look for somebody to hire, when I look to interviewing somebody, something like that, and you guys both know this, is as you went through the interview process with me, we as a business like to give a CTF like engagement for basically a test before we get you to the next, you know, critical interview, into the next, you know, phase of the interview process. We found it very hard at the beginning of our interview process to identify individuals that really knew what they were talking about. It's easy to plug in buzzwords. It's easy to plug in, you know, yeah, let me just Google that on the side and say, yeah, I know what a TCP/IP stack is. I know what a XXS is. And I know what these types of exploits and things like that are. And so, you know, I had watched the community a little bit, you know, reached out, and I saw what people were saying. Like, look, people really enjoy these CTS as a way to showcase their skill, because it does two things. One, it showcases the skill of the candidate, the saying that I can do this type of stuff. And then from an employer's perspective, I can really see the potential of the candidate. And when I say potential, I mean, there have been many CTFs that people have taken from our company as they've gone to the interview process. And some people get this flag, some people miss this flag. And my favorite question to ask a candidate as they go through the interview process is, I want, what rabbit holes did you go down? What didn't work? And why did you think that way? Because if they can give me an answer that says, well, the reason why I went is I saw this, this, and this, and they can kind of walk me through their problem-solving process, you know, I could be like, he knows the content. He knows where to look. He may just have, or he or she may have just missed you know, a breadcrumb along the way that would have pointed him in the right direction. And showing me that, you know, I did all this research, I looked here, here, and here, and it could have been completely off of where the actual target could have been. But it shows me that willingness and that drive and that passion to learn. And I think that's the most important thing that people in this field, which shocking to me as a young person growing up and doing schooling and things like that, I never liked learning. I hated puzzles. I hated doing that type of education younger. But now, I mean, it's a thrill to me. It's a dopamine rush when you get that first shell back and you're able to solve it. Be like, here's the place that I need to go. Here's how I go from user to root, or from user to admin. And having that kind of mentality when you approach a problem, I think is very telling of a person. And that's when I know, when I talk to a person, I interview a person, and they can walk me through that and showcase, this is why I went this way, because, and here's all my references, here's where I went and looked, here's how I went and read up, I read about this tool, I read about this technique. Then even if they didn't get 100, or even if they didn't get 90%, I mean, if they can communicate and showcase that, I mean, we're interested. As a company, we're interested, because that shows me that they can go for it and they can learn.
See, I'm a CTS sadist when you give me a 24-hour time limit. That's my right. Put me in a box and I'll figure out how to get out of it.
Oh yeah, chug monsters the entire 24 hours and
good
to go.
Yeah.
And that's what I've heard the most, Sam, is people talking about building themselves out of a box. It's a challenge. I hopefully I'm not a sadist when I'm like, you know, give them 48 hours, you know, like don't give them just a 24-hour period. I want enough time, and I understand life commitments and things like that are hard sometimes. And so finding a straight 24 hours and then delivering a report 24 hours later is kind of a high commitment to ask of candidates. So giving them 48 hours for the assessment plus another 48 hours to write the report. I mean, they can do it over weekend. They can do it nights and weekends after hours. You know, maybe they have other family or life obligations. So giving them that, I feel it's a little bit of a, you know, an opportunity for them to really showcase their skill set, because it's not just the technical piece of it. It's also the communication we look for. Not that everybody has to be the best report writer or the best public speaker, especially from people like us in our backgrounds. Traditionally, some of us are not the best when it comes to being an extrovert type of a person. But as long as you can effectively communicate what happened, why it's important, and where the risk is, that's just an added bonus as a candidate.
Well, I think those soft skills are often overlooked, and they're important. But I agree with you. I don't think they're a deal breaker if someone comes to me and says, hey, I really like security, I really like doing this, but I don't think I'm a good writer, or I don't think I'm very good at presenting the findings that I've identified, things like that. And my response to them is always, it's just like your technical skills, the soft skills take practice. You need to be in front of people. You need to be talking to people. You need to be practicing writing, because they're not like a God-given talent. They are learned. There's something you have to put time into to get something of value out of them, just like the same skills that we use on the technical side. Chase poked a little bit of fun at offensive security, but their cert, the OSCP, the Offensive Security Certified Professional, is kind of one of those benchmark certificates for people in this sphere. And I think it's more so because it hinges on a couple of key things, one of them being methodology.
Yep.
If you don't have a good methodology going into that exam, because it is only 24 hours, you won't get it done. More often than not, maybe you can stumble through it, but if you don't have a process in place of how to go through a box, how to understand, enumerate, find vulnerabilities, and work them, you're not going to get through the exam. And the other piece of that is it actually requires you to write a report. Similar to what we do here at BLS, the CTF, you know, like Mike said, you've got a time limit, so you need to have that process down. You need to know your methodology. You need to be able to walk through it, but then you have to do the report. And BLS, we actually, I think you do this for all candidates, that you have them present, like do an actual outbrief, right? That's you didn't just do that for me, right?
Correct. Yeah. Everybody's got to go through that.
So, you know, we get to point to those soft skills and the importance of them.
They're just as important as the technical skills, because that's what we're selling, is the report. We're not actually selling our hacks. We're selling the how, the why, and the what. It's like that. There's a talk at Cleveland B-Sides. Yeah. It was by someone at Black Hills. I can't
remember. King.
Yeah, Rubber King. Thank you, Sam, for guiding me through this.
I love this talk.
The talk was titled Hack for Show, Report for Dough. And that tagline is accurate. Like, we're not selling the hacking. We're selling the report.
Yeah. I think I send that talk to anyone who asks me how to become like a red teamer or a professional pen tester, because that is at its core the penultimate concept that you need to get your head around to do this. Like, you can spend all day learning your technical skills, but if you cannot put together a report that accurately displays what you found and how you found it, nobody's going to pay you to do this.
Yeah. And also, maybe, just maybe, this is something from the blue team side, don't be an arrogant ass to your clients. You know, I know that's a hard concept for some individuals to grasp, but yeah, they're the ones paying you. Be nice.
I got stories on that, but those will have to wait for the podcast where we have Brian on it.
You know, I kind of like what you said there, Sam, where you said, you know, these soft skills, they're not hard requirements, but I think in the course of an interview process, what would push me over the edge to, even though they may, that the candidate may not have the strongest technical skill, if they could be a good communicator, I mean, and they can do a good app brief and they can showcase impact and risk and quantify and qualify all this type of stuff, that may push us over to be like, you know what? He can learn. He's got the capability. He has the drive. He has the capacity to increase his capability on the technical side and sharpen those skills. But if he's a good communicator and a good writer, I mean, that just shows me how much more worth that candidate is, not only to himself and his capabilities of being a good communicator and a penetration tester, but to the company and being able to good, you know, communicator of why we did this and why you should care and why this is important.
As much as we all want to be considered hacker androids and soulless, lifeless robots, we, you know, at the end of the day, I think most of us are in this line of work because we care. Like, we want to make a difference. We want to do something to give back in one way or the other. You know, be it we want to advise companies on how to protect their data better to protect the consumer at the end level. Maybe, you know, we want to build tools that are designed around protecting people as they traverse the miasma that is the internet, right? At the end of the day, security, I think we're IT people who just want to help and yep. are also have a good dash of paranoia in what we do.
Yeah.
This podcast has been brought to you by Black Lantern Security. When you think of your company's position in the ever-evolving information age, what word comes to mind? Thriving? Agile? Cloud as a service? What about secure? Black Lantern Security offers consulting services to help in all spheres of cybersecurity. Our red team has assisted numerous clients with establishing their security baselines, assessing current risks, and validating security controls. Our blue team has been able to up the SOX logging and monitoring game, provide additional incident response support, and identify areas of improvement in a company's incident response plan. These services can help improve your company's security posture in an ever-changing internet era. To get more information, please visit blacklanternsecurity.com/contact us and fill out the form on the page. Again, that was blacklanternsecurity.com/contact us. And don't forget to mention the podcast in your message. I opened this episode saying that we wanted to talk about methodology, and we went on this really roundabout way to get here. But I think we're here now.
Yeah.
So, Mike, you lead, one way or the other, you lead our sort of operations team. You are the point person for our engagements and things like that. And we all, you know, learn from you. We look to you and to kind of follow your path and your methodology, not to a T, but, you know, for trying to better understand how you think of things. So can you, I guess, walk us through what you consider the hacker mindset or the hacker methodology?
So I'll speak from, you know, you sit me down and let's assume breach. Let's assume access. One of the first things, I mean, you can see this methodology. You can see this things grounded in things like the penetration testing standard and a lot of the other types of, you know, MITRE ATT&CK frameworks and OWASP and a lot of these other open source, you know, standards that the industry has come up with. My first thing that I like to do from an approach is, what am I? Where am I sitting at? Am I in a DMZ? Am I on a server? Am I on a workstation? What type of environment am I in? Am I on a Windows box, Linux box, whatever, you know, AIX, something weird like an AS400 or something like that. And then trying to just enumerate my surroundings. One of the most important things that I learned from just from a technique that I learned when I first started operating as a penetration tester and as a red teamer is treating every shell like it's your last. Never assume that the shell that you have or the access that you have is going to stay around. So make backups, make additional call-ins, and make sure that you have a way back in. Now, obviously, this is all with an asterisk of, you know, OPSEC or operational security, because when it comes down to it, depending on the purpose and the engagement type, you know, a penetration test is different in methodology and mentality than a red team. And you know, one penetration test is not necessarily need to be covert in its mission and its purpose. So you have a little bit more leeway. We typically like to try to get caught, and we like to be able to readily identify and deconflict that access, so that if there are blue teamers or if there are defenders, that we make it easy for them so that they don't have to spend cycles and time and effort to see if it's a real threat actor operating in their environment. I think most recently in the past, you know, year or so, you've had these very large publicized attacks, and we have to be very cognizant as a service company that's providing, you know, penetration testing and red teaming services and risk assessments and things like that, to be respectful of those teams, because there may be an active engagement or maybe an actual real threat actor within the environment that we have to be considerate of. So when I say making sure that you treat every shell like it's your last, is that you may not want to actually get another shell or have that redundancy to begin with, depending on the course of engagement. But barring that, and with that out of the way, you know, what can I see, what can I do, and where can I go? Again, depending on the length of the engagement, we know we may have to move a little bit faster. We may have to, you know, speak very loudly, if you will, and raise that noise threshold on the network. So doing some initial scanning, you know, either passively or actively listening on the network. You know, maybe it might be using tool sets like SharpView or using things like Seatbelt that are out there, kind of that enumeration on the host, trying to see, you know, what can I do? Where could I possibly go? What network shares do I have enumerated? You know, what type of documents would this person maybe consuming if I got in through a phishing payload, or if I got in through like a web shell or some type of web host? You know, what type of database connections does this have? What databases is it connecting to? Are those databases connected in the sense that I can find their credentials and then reuse them to see maybe if I could pivot through there? You know, if it's like a Microsoft SQL database, you know, could I pivot and use something like XP Command Shell to do that? Or maybe just the enumerating the databases, looking for additional credentials that I could maybe elevate my presence from a regular user context to an administrative context if I got something like SQL injection or something like that. And so it's really just kind of understanding what's your immediate perimeter look like. If given the opportunity, you know, if depending on how loud you can be, and again, being cognizant of operational security and your OPSEC, you know, do I want to enumerate the domain if I'm in one? You know, what kind of users are there? What kind of other systems are around me? You know, Bloodhound is a very popular tool in the past 5-6 years to really help with that, getting that kind of understanding. And then from there, it's just a matter of digesting the data and kind of looking in. I can't count the number of times where I've landed in a context, I'm on a user's workstation, and I really don't have anything available to me to either escalate or pivot or even get a hash out of the user. And lo and behold, if I just take some time and be a little bit methodical about looking at what access I do have, maybe they have, as simple as it sounds, a password text file sitting on their desktop. And while incredibly easy that sounds, it is far more of a common attack vector than not.
Was I not supposed to be doing that, Mike?
You're not supposed to do I take the sticky off of my monitor that has my passwords and things
no,
like
not
that?
Not on the monitor. It's under the keyboard. Come on. Everyone under checks the monitor.
That's right.
I would rather have you stick it under your keyboard than as a notepad document on your desktop.
Yeah. I mean, at least it's out. It's sneaker netted at that point. It's network segmented, if you will. It's not a something that it's a digital artifact that I can get to.
Yeah. Remote attacker Mike can't get to it under my keyboard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could always just...
Fingers aren't that long.
So, in my opinion, I think one of the most important skills, and this kind of goes into what you were saying, Mike, that a pen tester can develop is the ability to adequately prioritize things. Yeah. Being like, when we go into an engagement, we have a week or so, sometimes longer, sometimes less, and sometimes up to 100,000 plus systems. And being able to determine your goal and prioritize your ways to get to that goal, prioritize the low-hanging fruit and the high-value targets, and being able to just quickly go through those, determine when you're in a rabbit hole and need to pivot and all that, just being able to keep on track helps you immensely during an engagement.
Yeah, it's really hard. And again, this goes back to the obsession and the compulsive that some of the people in the industry have, is that, man, if you get a feeling and you get a hint, you're like, man, I really feel like there's something here. I can remember a time of doing an assessment where I landed on a Linux system and I was trying my hardest to figure out a way to escalate on this system. It was a system that was patched, that had the latest updates. I was in a very limited user context. But what I noticed was that there were certain, you know, cron jobs and certain processes that were running that once I took inventory of them and I said, well, that's weird. This system is, you know, it has the set UIT bit on it. And I'm like, what does this application actually do? And, you know, if you ran the application, there was no help. There was nothing that spit out on the console. But simply just running a simple strings command on it, which I am by no means a reverse engineer. I've dabbled in the dark arts, if you will, but I've never actually been an active partitioner of that. Running strings on the binary, all of a sudden output, it said, oh, you just need to pass it two arguments. And all of a sudden, it will execute whatever you give it, and it'll execute a script as root. And I was like, I mean, I must have spent a couple of days on that box trying to figure out a way to escalate. And lo and behold, it was just something that, you know, developer randomly set, probably didn't think about it, didn't think anybody would ever get into that context. And it was something so simple that led to ultimately the compromise of that system, which led to further on to getting further into that particular enclave, into that that enterprise. So that was a fun one.
Just if someone isn't comfortable with Linux, cron jobs are specifically jobs that are set at automated windows, either to execute daily, weekly, monthly, things like that. That's actually not an uncommon methodology for privilege escalation, because developers or sysadmins have regular jobs that they need to run or have data that they need to collect regularly that is only accessible at a root or privileged level. And they design these scripts that are simple, but drop them into cron and ignore them or forget about them and let them run and deliver reports. I think even just from the less consequential perspective of capture the flag boxes or CTF boxes, that is, if you're not checking cron on any Linux system, you're going to miss the privilege escalation almost 9 times out of 10. So hearing that that's a reality within, like, actual environments that you used this against just goes back to point to, you know, it may seem silly in a CTF when you do it, but you never know when that kind of technique is going to apply.
The amount of times that I've done a CTF and been like, no one would actually do this in a real environment, and then I went to a real environment and saw that, is depressing.
Yeah, I remember some of the Hack the Box and some of the OSCP boxes I went against where, I mean, they were actually harder than I've gone up to some, you know, Fortune 500 companies. And it's, I don't think it's laziness by IT personnel. I think it's just a matter of, they're probably just not aware that the things that they do on a daily basis as a part of their job could be used against them. Cron jobs is one example, but just simply just looking at the history on a Linux system can probably give you a lot of data. Looking at the bash environmental variable set, looking at the, you know, bash RC or the environmental settings on the system, let alone just looking at the processes that are listening on there, because, you know, if you don't configure your program appropriately, you know, you could be leaking sensitive information just through command line arguments, because those could be leaked in that way. Things like commonly, you know, just world readable files that you probably shouldn't have a lower level access to. Nobody expects their web logic or JBoss or WebSphere system to be compromised, and then you all of a sudden start operating as the user that executed those applications, because there's probably sensitive database connection string in there that you wouldn't want to expose, but they got execution into that context. And so one of the first things that I do when I land an exploit like that or a misconfiguration, as I just go looking for additional credentials that could lead me to an Oracle database, you know, JDBC, you know, connection string or something of that nature, that would get me to that next step. Even if I pivot, but I only pivot at a lower level access, that other additional asset may have more access than I do over here. And a very common theme that I've seen is you may land on a production system, and while you may not have the access that you want on that production system, sometimes there's, you know, dual, you know, test systems, user access testing, UAT or dev or non-prod systems, that same credential or context is actually elevated in another one, and then you can swing back to that other system either through, you know, SSH keys or some other type of, you know, maybe you can get to the shadow file specifically on Linux that could allow you to come swing back into that context at a higher context than where you started.
Well, two concepts that exist in the computing world that generally butt heads are the concept of convenience versus security, right? You do something to make either your job or your clients or something like that, their lives more convenient at the risk of making something less secure, because you run into this a lot with like automation tasks or a lot with, like you were saying, you know, you set up this dedicated user thinking that no one else is going to touch it. And it's all it does is run JBoss or all it does is run your HTTP Apache server or something like that. But you stop considering what else this user can do, what else this user has access to, which, you know, that limited perspective can be the downfall more often than not.
Yeah, and this goes back to at the beginning of this discussion when we were talking about how everyone can benefit from learning kind of the hacker mindset and learning how they would approach things, because these developers and admins and all that, if they knew the consequences of some of these convenient things, they would probably approach it differently at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I remember a conversation I had with one of our other engagement customers where, you know, they didn't understand, you know, how we could have escalated and pivoted and moved through there. You know, they had, you know, they said that they had a DMZ. They said that they had host-based security controls. They said that they had, you know, going as far as like a NAC and having network access controls or an 802.1.x, you know, certificate deployment. You know, when we showed up on site, they were like, well, they hadn't known beforehand that we have done some previous activity before we had shown up to do the assessment per our rules of engagement. And then what they were like, well, you know, before we let you on the network, we were going to see if you could maybe bypass our network protections. And then I said, there are ways to do this. There's techniques, there's things like that. And again, it's this constant fight between time versus, you know, what value the company's going to get out of you for maybe only a week assessment. And so I was like, look, you know, I had already gotten domain admin through a prior exploit and escalation. And, you know, they said, oh, really? And I said, yeah. And, you know, I walked them through the attack and, you know, it turned up to a longer conversation with their IT admins and some of the other personnel where, you know, we had to explain, you know, how the pivot happened and how the access was gained, even though they had all these additional things, which they had this feeling or this idea of security because they were doing the right things. It's just that there was a couple of things that either they are aware of or had forgotten about because of the, you know, changing of the guard, if you will, as old employees had left and new employees had come on and they weren't aware of the same process and procedures that they had done before. And then all of a sudden, there's leftover credentials sitting on the, you know, Active Directory share that all it takes is a simple reverse engineering of, you know, either some base64 or some other type of obfuscation, which they thought was secure, actually ended up not being that. And all of a sudden that leads to a further compromise of those sorts of things.
Man, I'm looking at the recording time. More of the stories, I think we're going to have you on again because I think you've got a lot of insight and perspective that I want to keep talking about. But I think we'd be remiss if we didn't touch on this concept. Mike, you are, by all means, a professional hacker. You are, you know, you do this day in, day out, and you've learned the hard way. And I think an important thing for especially junior hackers out there, junior security folks, or even, you know, IT folks out there, learning from your mistakes are one of the biggest things you have to do. So can you give us a highlight of an interesting story or an interesting mistake that you've experienced yourself that actually impacted a client or was a bigger deal than you're used to having to experience that you learned significantly from?
You know, it's these hacker horror stories that sometimes I'll be either sitting on a bench by myself and like the thought pops in my head and you kind of have that, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. And you just kind of, it's just like this painful wince that you have. You're like a terrible thought in your head.
It's like thinking back to high school or something.
Like, oh, remember that one time I completely embarrassed myself in front of that girl as I was trying to impress her? Oh, man. Yeah. but yeah, you know, there are important lessons to learn that I think every hacker, red team, security enthusiast, professional is going to experience. What they go through may change from person to person, from experience to experience. But after you get burned in that way, you're a little bit shy the next time. And it's typically a good thing. And hopefully it's one that you don't, it isn't super, you know, detrimental to either the environment or the customer. One of the most important things that, you know, our community has, and this is really relevant as of recently, with all the potential exploits that have been coming out, unfortunately, for Microsoft or for some of the other big guys like SolarWinds, is you really got to make sure that you review and not only review the tools that you plan to use, but also you understand. The guy who made Responder announced that he was no longer going to support the tool. It's going end of life. And Responder is one of my favorite tools to use when I first land in an environment, especially when I'm doing like a network penetration test and I have my own box on the network and things like that. Just from a user enumeration or from a system enumeration, it's really interesting just to see what's there to put it kind of in a passive analysis mode. But one of my screw-ups for fame, if you will, is when that tool first came out, I was still very green. I really didn't know how to use the tool or understand the tool and didn't spend enough time playing with the tool to make sure I understood what the implications of it were. And I may or may not have accidentally shut down a very important medical facility for a very short time. And it wasn't anything that posed a threat to, you know, people's health. It wasn't actually any type of thing that hooked up to a patient or anything. But you have to be very cognizant of the fact that if an organization is actively using their WPAD settings with their internet browser for internal proxies, you need to make sure that you're doing appropriate forwarding of that traffic, because you inadvertently can do a man-in-the-middle attack, but if you never pass it on, it really doesn't become, you know, kind of a man-in-the-middle. It just becomes a DOS. And so what I learned from that is to first understand the tool, use it in a lab first and foremost, and play with it, make sure you understand how it works and how it can impact things. And two, definitely put it into analysis mode first before you just start slinging something like that across the network. So without going into too much further detail, a lot of alarms went off and quickly were notified of the impact of that, which, after understanding the tool, it was very easy to reverse it. It just required a little bit of time for caches to expire and things to return to their regular operating state. But that's the one that I always keeps me up at night. And whenever I look at new tools, that's kind of my scar, my burn scar of saying, let me take a second before I launch this.
Isn't it a fun feeling when your stomach just drops and you're like, oh, fuck.
This is my fault.
Yeah.
I always ask customers, like, hey, is there anything you want blacklisted from what we do? Because the last thing I want to do is impact someone just trying to do their day-to-day job.
Yeah, at the end of the day, we're paid and we are there to help the continuity, the uptime of systems. And the last thing that we want to do is take any way away from that. There are important tests, important stress testing, like doing a forcible, you know, DDoS or DOS tool if you're trying to stress test something, but it's never our intent and it's never our goal to tip anything over
unless they deserve it,
you know? Disclaimer, yeah exactly,
security does not maliciously hack or go against anybody intentionally.
We do have clauses that due to the nature of the testing, things may become unstable at times.
The last thing we want to do is impact operations for anybody.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mike, first off, foremost, thank you. Sitting down and talking to you is always a joy, even though I think over the last 2 weeks, I might have talked to you more than I've talked to my wife, but that's okay. That is the nature of the job.
It's true. It's true.
Anything you want to plug, any personal blogs or anything, any GitLabs or anything like that outside of the BLS scope that you want to plug?
No, my life is pretty boring outside of the BLS mentality and livelihood. So any plug for BLS is a plug for me, I guess.
You mind if I plug my OnlyFans real quick, Sam?
I do mind. And request denied. Request denied. So with that said, everyone, thank you for listening. Really appreciate your time. Our Twitter is at anyport_pod. Please give us a follow and reach out there. Let us know if there's any topics that you guys want us to cover or anything going forward. More than happy to see what we can do. Additionally, please follow Black Lantern Security at Black Lantern Security LLC on Twitter for any news about tools or blogs coming from there.
And if any of the traits we discussed resonate with you, feel free to apply to Black Lantern Security on our website, blacklanternsecurity.com/jobs.
Is that right? I think it's /jobs.
Yeah, they could, if they can't find /jobs, I think we don't need to worry about.
Wow.
It's on our landing page. It's fine. It's pretty easy.
Yeah, it's on the front page. If they can't find that, then.
All right. Again, I don't know how to end this.